Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
The topic of artificial intelligence has become a critical one lately. There is a ton of chatter about AI right now. It's become one of the most pressing issues of our time. And unfortunately, in the midst of all this noise, I think the most important and profound question about AI is getting very little attention. And that question is this: is it possible for AI to become truly intelligent? This is the question that we are asking today on Think for Christ. Now, it's not as if this question isn't being asked at all. I just don't think it's being asked seriously enough. And it's not being asked to the right people. Popular culture is looking to technology moguls, computer engineers, cognitive scientists for the answer. But I submit that the question of whether an AI can ever become truly intelligent is not one that can be answered by scientists, because it's not a scientific question. Before we can ever know whether AI is or can be intelligent like a human being, we first have to know the nature of human intelligence. But of course, to ask about the nature of intelligence is to ask a philosophical question, not a scientific one. Which is why I've invited a philosopher to join me today who also happens to be one of my former professors. He's here to help us think through this critical and philosophical question. Dr. J.T. Bridges, welcome to Think for Christ.
Thanks, Dr. Alberino.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Hey, by the way, how's it feel to be the very first guest on Think for Christ?
Oh, great. Yeah.
That's something, huh?
Yeah. I looked at some of your content. I really like, I like your setup. It looks good. Sounds good. Good content.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Why don't you just take a minute or two just to introduce yourself to the Think for Christ community here?
Okay. Dr. J.T. Bridges. Professor of philosophy at Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. I teach a variety of philosophy classes, mostly metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of science, ethics, politics, and aesthetics, all the value theory things. Teach Aristotelian symbolic logic. So, those sorts of things. Have been a full-time professor for a little over a decade, 12 years, I think now. Finished my doctorate in the epistemology of the sciences. It was kind of my focus of my doctoral research, but philosophy, religion, Thomism, right? So we'll bring up St. Thomas Aquinas because we think he's right, and we'll explain his correct views to everybody, hopefully. So the interaction between theories of cognition, epistemology, the sciences, that's been kind of my bailiwick for about a decade now. So with the emergence of the question of artificial intelligence, it really does, as you said in the introduction, it really does point us back to, what is the artificial modifying, right? Because we're talking about what is natural intelligence, such that we can use it as a gauge of whether or not we have produced something sufficiently called artificial intelligence. There are technological sides of things. I'm not a computer programmer or a computer scientist or architect or some people like that. Not a mathematician. A lot of this stuff is built off of pretty heady math.
Sure.
But the way you frame the question is what is the nature of intelligence? Not like, because somebody like a psychologist, like you could have Jordan Peterson on here and ask him about intelligence, and he would point you to probably psychological studies or studies measuring IQ, mm-hmm. right? And he would talk to you about demographics of men and women, ethnicities, and historical epochs where IQ has ebbed and flowed or waxed and waned and, you know, things like that. But just so the audience is aware, this is not the kind of conversation that we're intending to have today.
That's right. No.
We're intending to have a philosophical conversation of what does it mean for an embodied soul to know.
Right? That's right. Yeah. So we will be bracketing some of the more technical aspects of the conversation that you would have with a computer scientist, say, mm-hmm. or even like a neuroscientist. So we'll be sticking strictly to the philosophical questions. So JT, I don't have any official polling on this, but it seems to me that there is widespread belief in our culture today that a sufficiently advanced or sophisticated machine or computer could one day become sentient or conscious mm-hmm. or intelligent. And I think this is a belief that it's not only held by the general public, or it's not just a belief that's kind of floating around in popular culture, but even many scientists today and philosophers hold it as well. Now, again, as it seems to me, in order to consistently entertain a belief like this, we have to entertain certain other beliefs about what we've been talking about, the nature of human intelligence. So what do you think about that? What are some of the philosophical assumptions about human intelligence that are required for the belief that a machine or a computer or a program or a robot could become intelligent?
Yeah, I think the place to start is there's an article from I think 2015 by a guy named Robert Epstein who's a psychologist, but he wrote an article called The Empty Brain, where he talks about how over the last 40 or 50 or 60 years or so since computers and computer modeling have increased, and he calls it the information processing view of human cognition, right? And so he references this book by George Zarkadakis, which is has his PhD in AI, but he references that book, and I got it later, but he talks about how throughout human history, there's been this compulsion to take the most sophisticated machinery of the time and use that as an analogy for understanding human nature. So, for example, in Descartes' time, say roughly early 17th century, something like that, 1600s, the most intricate machinery was the pulley system and then the gears, mm-hmm. And so people would say, well, a human being is just in a complex series of humors and pulleys and springs and gears, right? So with the advent of computation, we now had something that was a ready-made analog to something like the human mind.
Right.
So he calls it the information processing analogy to human cognition. He says it's wrong, coming from a psychological perspective. He said, you don't have files in your mind. You don't have memory files or picture JPEGs and things like that. He says human cognition is not information processing in its nature. And then I heard this, when I was being introduced to Elon Musk and some of his views of technology and his and the future and things like that. I heard Elon Musk mention that, it's highly likely that we live in a computer simulation. And so I tracked down, I think it's a 2003 article that I think at Oxford published 2003 article. I can't remember the name of the author who originally wrote this argument about that, odds are that we're living in it's highly likely that we're living in a computer simulation. And in the abstract, in the opening pages of that article, that author basically commits himself to the idea that if human knowing or human cognition just is something like computational processing, mm-hmm. and what is it, Moore's law, that technology is increasing, doubling every, say, 18, 24 months, something like that. Mm-hmm. He says, if you work that timeline out, then in 1,000 years, our computing ability is going to be billions of times faster, more sophisticated. And so It is likely that
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
That what we're experiencing. And he says in that original article, he says, then what will advanced civilizations do? Well, they'll start running simulations on evolution and processes and trying to predict models for the future. And the more they do this, the more sophisticated their simulations become, the more and more the entities within those simulations will be less and less aware that they're part of a simulation.
Hmm.
But all of that reduces back to an assumption that what human knowing is a kind of computational information processing,
right?
Experience. And so both this sort of Elon Musk assumption that, you know, it's highly likely that we're living in a computer simulation, and this question about AI really does go back to what Epstein calls an information processing view of human cognition. And that being the linchpin, if that is a mistake, I think it is a mistake, then both of those pathways of reasoning about how we interact with our environment and then what the nature of AI both of those things just fall flat.
That's
so
right.
I think we're really getting at something that is a crucial assumption for this sort of reasoning. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it sounds like the view that you were espousing there, it sounds like that would end in just radical skepticism. I mean, I feel like you would just be in epistemological darkness if his argument holds water.
Yeah, and I've seen this move made in other contexts. So, for example, there was a television show, I think it was called Brain Games, right? And I watched a couple episodes this years ago, and you know they put what was it? One of them was they had a person stand about 10 feet away from a big, you know, not a cardboard, but a big visual aid, and the visual aid had one trapezoid that was gray on the top and another trapezoid that was gray on the bottom. And they stood back a certain distance and they said, which one is darker gray? And they said, well, the one on the bottom is darker. And come to find out, they're exactly the same shade of gray, but at a certain angle, at a certain distance, with a certain lighting, the grays look distinguishable, even though they're identical, right? And so the common theme of these episodes of Brain Games is they would take some aspect of sense perception and show how our initial prima facie interaction with that sense perception was wrong. And so we can't trust our sense perception. And what I teach my students about this sort of move is this. How do they know that those grays are quote unquote actually identical grays?
That's right.
And the answer is more sense perception.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that we have any information outside of our minds is through our senses. And the only way that we can call into question or correct misperception is through more perception. But to call into question that, as you said, this sort of this global skepticism that my senses that my senses could potentially always be lying to me. Well, how would you ever know? Right.
Right.
It's back to our sort of Cartesian.
That's right.
Question. But
yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So, the view sounds to me something very similar, like the computational theory of mind in the mm-hmm. philosophy of mind. I mean, it sounds like that's kind of what he's espousing, that basically the mind is like a program or software that's being run on the hardware of the brain.
Yeah.
Very, very, very popular view today. And that itself, I think, is kind of a subset of a larger view in the philosophy of mind called functionalism. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that functionalism itself is a subset of a of this larger project in the philosophy of mind to reduce all of the mental to the physical, right? So you've been talking here, taking the angle of epistemology. But for me, it seems like, speaking from maybe more of a, like a position of ontology, it just seems like a lot of these theories that we're getting today are coming to us as one or another form of physical reductionism, right? Where we're trying to reduce the mental to the physical, that the only thing that exists are physical things. The mind is part of the physical world. And therefore the mind is in some sense like a biological machine. And if you begin with this perspective, if this is your ontology, right, if this is your metaphysics, then it doesn't seem like it's a very big step to go from that view of the mental to the idea, well, if the mind is just a biological machine, then it should be possible, right? Maybe not feasible right now, but it should be possible at some point when our technology is sufficiently sophisticated and advanced, it should be possible to be able to reverse engineer what's happening in these biological machines, right? And reproduce it in something else, in something made of silicon, for example, or a robot or a computer. How much do you think that the project of physical reductionism is playing into these really popular computational theories of the mind?
Yeah, very much so. So I guess there's a few things. I've got a couple of competing ideas here. First of all, yes, there's the sort of these epiphenomenalism, this that, you know, if we just have a complex enough underlying physical system, what emerges from that is this epiphenomenon that is
causally effete.
Right. Yeah. It's it's a sum that's greater than the parts type thing. But there's a couple books going back to 2011. There's one in 2017 and then 2021. Some of them printed at either Harvard or MIT Press, and the pendulum there is swinging back the other way. There's a book in 2011. I can't remember the author, but it's called Radical Embodied Cognitive Science.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to swing back the other way and just very much reduce anything computational to just functional interactions.
That's right. Neurons.
But yeah, all of this very much assumes a I've been an Aristotelian Thomist so long, it's hard for me to put my feet in the shoes of someone who's wrong. kidding, but not kidding. So I think so. We talked earlier about when we talk about intelligence, we're talking about the knowing powers of an embodied soul, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But even taking a step further back from that is having a philosophy of nature of form, matter, composition.
Right.
So part of this reductionist move really tries to eliminate form from matter.
That's right.
And it tries to reduce things to a material substrate that is uninformed. And that itself is I think not possible. So yes, there's a problem with this reductionism in the philosophy of mind. But the philosophy of mind itself is situated within a view of human nature, which is itself situated within a philosophy of nature. Like what are concrete particulars, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so you would have to be something like, I would say probably a bundle theorist would be the best fit for a reductive materialist view of mind, right? So what is cognition? It's information processing. The embodiment of it is just its circuitry and whatever you know, say data, the positronic brain or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
I lost my train of thought.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, because we're Aristotelians, we're going to say the problem isn't anything that's happening in the 21st century. Ultimately, it goes back to where you began with Descartes, mm-hmm. and the shift from the classical view of nature and matter specifically to that mechanistic view of matter, where matter is just inert, you know, It has no qualities except those which can be defined mathematically, and any kind of intelligibility that it has, any kind of finality, mm-hmm. has to be imposed on it from the outside. And there's no intrinsic teleology, right? Yeah, there's no directedness. So I think so many of those in the philosophy of mind today, in neuroscience and what have you, they're working from this mechanistic view of matter, which just denudes the material world of all of those qualities that the classical guys pointed out. And, you know, they said that matter has to have, given our experience of reality. So I agree with you. It's hard especially when you're thinking from that classical model, it's hard to put yourself and situate yourself in the position of so much of the philosophy of mind today, because so much of it does kind of launch from that mechanistic view of matter, which just gets it wrong from the get-go. But go ahead.
No, and you know, for the benefit of your audience, you know, I'm sure the lingering question is, well, what's left out? You know, if you were a scientist and you're a cognitive scientist, you go, well, why can't I just reduce human cognition or human thinking or knowing to an advanced neural net, and then make the assumption or infer from that I can reproduce something like a neural net in something artificial, and then I would have effectively reproduced something that is akin to human knowing. And the reductive materialist, what it leaves out are Hilary Putnam and Fazer do a really good job of explaining the nature of both thought experiments and the nature of identity. Hilary Putnam, two things are identical when they have all their properties in common, right? So Putnam gives the example of H2O and water. Mm-hmm. People have known, I mean, prehistoric people knew what water was, but it's only relatively recently that we understand that water's molecular structure is H2O, right? Because we know that H2O and water are identical, right? This substance that we call water is molecularly H2O. Because they're identical, there is no property that water has that H2O doesn't have. Or else there would be some level of non-identity between the two. But they're exactly identical, which means they have all their properties in common. If one thing on one side of the equation has a property that the other one doesn't have, then by definition they're not identical, right? So if human cognition is reducible to matter, energy, and motion, right? This is the materialism. Then everything about the brain, everything about material systems brain and mind should be identical. Everything that we say about the brain should
have all the same properties.
Exactly, exactly. So the question is, well, are there properties that the mind has that the brain not only doesn't have, but can't have? And there are at least two properties that are sort of my go-to properties that I think about. One is intentionality, and the other is abstraction, right? And intentionality is the more fundamental one, and that is intentionality is the property of being about something else, right? So intentionality, thoughts, you know, what are you doing? I'm thinking. What's the follow-up? What are you thinking about? Thoughts have intentionality. Words have intentionality, you know. There's a whole subdomain of linguistics called semiotics, and semiotics, you know, rides this threshold between the nature of language and how language functions as a sign, right? Semiotics is a study of words as signs or study of signs. And a sign is something that is about something else. Like when you pull up to a stop sign is a thing of itself. It's a octagonal.
Right. It has its own material nature.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But it's also about something. It's a command.
That's right.
It holds an imperative for us, right? Mm-hmm. Even if the word stop was painted over, you pull up to a red octagonal sign, you would stop your car, right? Because it's about something else. Well, thoughts, memories, all of these, a lot of this mental phenomenon has this property of intentionality. But material objects don't have that. Just material systems don't have that. If I said I found I pinpointed a neuron in the brain, right? The follow-up is not, well, what's that neuron
about? What's it about? Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You know? It's like, the pH of my bloodstream is a little bit basic. I'm it's up to 7.2. You go, well, what's the pH in your bloodstream about? Chemical systems and neurochemical systems, they don't have the property of intentionality, but mental phenomena do. They have the property of intentionality. And so there's at least one glaring, non-identical property between the physical brain and what we experience as mental phenomena. And the other is abstraction. You know, abstraction for, you know, we know that abstraction is here's an obtuse triangle, here's an acute triangle, here's an equilateral triangle, and they're all triangles. Well, how do I go beyond the individual instances of triangles and have a concept of triangularity? Because the concept of triangularity, you know, this geometric form with three sides, three internal angles, it prescinds from every instance of triangle.
That's right. Right?
So
it ranges over all triangles.
That's right.
It's a one over the many, and nothing material. Everything material is an individual, right? Yeah. It's a particular. You can't have a material thing that is a one that ranges over a many. The only thing that can kind of fit that is a concept,
right?
Just like you're saying, you have that abstract universal concept of triangle, for example, that can't be identified with any specific triangle that we could instantiate in the material world. It ranges over all possible instantiations of particular triangles, and there's nothing material that has that property. And like you said, if there's a property that is had by a concept that is not had by a material thing, then that alone crushes the idea that the two are identical.
That's right.
Right. There is this property that they do not share. Therefore, they are not identical.
That's right. So intentionality and universality, the idea that concepts have an aboutness and that they're universal in their scope. I mean, it's why we have the discussion about the difference between abstract objects and concrete particulars. Because there is a glaring non-identity between that which is abstract and that which is concrete. And if anything else, the materialist reductionist is trying to draw something about human thinking that is itself concrete.
Right.
So, I think that's go ahead.
Yeah. And there's another problem too, that's often brought up in the literature, and it goes broadly as the problem of consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. Or what David Chalmers has called the hard problem of consciousness. And it seems like there's a problem for the materialist in that there seems to be an unbridgeable logical and metaphysical gap between facts about brain chemistry, mm-hmm. like the wiring of neurons and the like, on the one hand, and then facts about conscious experience on the other. So one thing that's often pointed out is that consciousness is very different than the kind of descriptions that we get from science. The conscious experience is subjective. It's private. It's mind dependent. It's a first person point of view. None of this is captured by the physics, chemistry, biology of the brain. You know, you can do all the possible study, even considering the fact that our science is going to advance 100 years from now, let's say. You can study all of the physical interactions, all the stuff of the brain, the network, all the physical interactions that's going on with neurons and neural pathways and networks and what have you, but you'll never ever get to something that resembles.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Consciousness, like you could do a full study on how it is that we see the color red, right? Yeah. In terms of electromagnetism and how light works and how the signals from photons go from the thing to our eye and then it gets, you know, processed by the brain, but none of that will ever tell you what it feels like to see red, right? The, right. The what it's likeness of experience red, and in the philosophy of mind, this is called qualia.
Qualia, right? That's right.
So there's something that it feels like. There's some experience to see what red looks like, or to taste salt, or to experience anger. There are these subjective first person facts about qualia that just seem to be non-physical facts. Here's another example of a non-identity conferring property, right? Between the mental and the physical, that we have qualia. There seems to be facts that are additional to all the scientific facts about the material world. So, but if the brain's made up of the same stuff as the rest of the physical world, purposeless, odorless, colorless, tasteless particles, then how do you account for the rich experience of consciousness? So this is another thing that's brought up that is still an unanswered question. There's still just as much mystery today as there ever has been about this question in the philosophy of mind, in neuroscience. We're no closer to answering this problem of qualia than we were, you know, 30 years ago. So this is just another example, another problem that's often put beside the problem of intentionality, the problem of rationality.
Yeah. So George Zarkadakis, at the very end of his book, In Our Own Image, he says, a computer that behaves intelligently will be considered intelligent, even if it's a philosophical zombie.
That's right.
Right. So, zombies in the literature are creatures that have, they have all the behavior of a sentient human being, and yet they have zero qualia.
Right. Right. Right.
So it just points this fact out that, that AI, whatever it can do, it can't experience, right? So, yeah.
And the fact that we can conceive of a zombie, right, that has molecule for molecule identity with, right. let's say they make a zombie of me, right? Mm-hmm. Molecule by molecule, I am reproduced in another Anthony Alberino standing in front of me. The fact that I can conceive of this thing, this zombie, as having every physical particle that I have, but yet lacking qualia, lacking
and every aspect of your behavior. It could mimic every aspect of you're doing right now, and yet have nothing going on.
That's exactly right.
In terms of first person awareness, yeah.
And what these thought experiments do is, again, it just breaks the identity thesis, right? It just shows that if I can conceive of such a situation, then obviously there's properties that I have that a zombie wouldn't have, but a zombie is supposed to be a molecule for molecule exact replication of myself. And therefore we have another case of non-identity.
Right. Yeah. And going back to the water example, you talk about conceivability and then there's inconceivability. I cannot conceive of a property that water would have that H2O doesn't, right? Which is one of the things that that grounds our understanding that of identity.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And then there's that famous knowledge argument. This is put forward by Frank Jackson, or sometimes it's called the Mary's Room argument.
Yeah,
that is same
Mary
thing.
The neuroscientist.
That's right. You have a neuroscientist who's locked in a room, and somehow it's set up where she never sees color ever. So there's something on her eyes that prevents her from seeing color, or however it works out. But anyway, she's a neuroscientist. She does all the science. She figures out, you know, the nature of light, and she could tell you all the physical facts involved in color, right? Yeah. She could give you an accurate scientific representation of what color is, but she's never experienced color. And then the thought experiment says, well, let's take her out of that room, bring her outside. For the first time, she sees the color red. Mm-hmm. And she has this experience of seeing red. And this experience of seeing red, according to the argument, is going to be a fact over and above all of the physical facts that she already knew as a neuroscience about, you know, what it means to see something red. And mm-hmm. once again, we have an identity breaker. So there's lots of arguments like that. And if JT, if I could just kind of back up a little bit.
Sure.
So I said, so much of the conversation today is based on this ontological reductionism of mm-hmm. mental states, the mental, the mind to material, something material. And because of arguments like the ones we've been talking about, there's been a gradual retreat, right? I mean, it started, 50, 60 years ago, the going theory was reducing the mind to behaviorism. Mm-hmm. Well, that was thrown out. It was untenable. Then it was popular to try to reduce the mind to a brain, right? Or brain states. You have token or type identity theories.
Yeah.
Well, that was seen as untenable because of, you know, multiple realizability and other arguments put forth by Hillary Putnam.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like where we've landed now, and of course there are those who just want to eliminate the mind altogether. Just say there is no such thing as mind. And those are eliminativists.
Right.
They're on the extreme wing. But it seems like where we've landed. Yeah, exactly. Oddly, yeah.
Ironically enough.
Yeah, what an ironic name there. So it seems like where we've landed in terms of physical theories about the mind is the mind today, it's popularly seen as being reduced to some kind of a functional system, right? Mm-hmm. So we've landed on functionalism. So is there anything we can say about functionalism here? Because I think the reason it's important to bring up functionalism is because there's a direct link between functionalism and that computational theory of mind that you were talking about at the beginning.
Yeah. I haven't looked at philosophy of mind specifically for a few years, but I will say this. So I'm not boned up on functionalism per se, but I would say this. One of the problems is, you know, when I used to teach undergrad, I used to teach walk people through I was talking about Darwinism yesterday. So Descartes' substance dualism, and one of the things I did to, you know, shock or at least intrigue the undergrads is I would say the problem is that minds don't exist. Right, I just let them ponder that for a second, and it's true. Mind, just the notion of mind is a reification, right?
That's right.
What exists are human knowers, because what Aquinas will say. And so I was having a discussion a few weeks ago with somebody about this, the nature of self-awareness and consciousness in the context of AI. And I said, the problem is this: self-awareness or self-consciousness or sentience. Sentience is a phenomenological turning of the mind back on itself. When the mind is aware of itself as a knowing power, right? So we've reduced talk of the human to talk of the human mind to talk of consciousness. Right? What is the nature of consciousness? And all this becomes very mysterious. And it becomes mysterious because of these of these category mistakes.
Right.
Because what self-awareness is it's not a thing. Right, self-awareness isn't a thing; it's an experience of self that is an aspect of the mind, and the mind is a power of the soul, and mm-hmm. the soul is the rational form of the body. Right, so it by separating body and mind into two substances, and then taking soul and focusing on one of its powers. Knowing mind, and then focusing on one phenomena of mind, self-awareness or consciousness, we've whittled the conversation down to a phenomenological aspect of a power of one intrinsic metaphysical principle of an entire human being.
That's right.
We by this gradual dissolution, we find that we're unable to explain this mysterious thing that's going on, this mysterious phenomenon in self-awareness or consciousness.
Right.
Yeah, because that
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
It's three steps removed from what you would need to explain an integrated human experience.
Right.
But it happened over, you know, 300-400 years. And so people lose the scope of this whittling away until we're left with this ephemeral, vague notion of consciousness or sentience.
Yeah. It's almost like you're divorcing intelligence from the person who has an intellect. Right. Yeah. And all you're doing is you're focusing on the actual act of intelligence. And actually, that's actually a good way to understand functionalism, because what functionalism does is just basically says that what you have are functional states. This is what a mind is. A mind is just the functional states that takes causal inputs and then turns around and gives organized outputs. Mm-hmm. And that if that's all that intelligence is, again, completely divorced from anthropology, completely divorced from any understanding of what it is to be a human being, what it is to have the power of intellect and will, we're just looking at the activity of intelligence now. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to reduce that down to something physical. And functionalism just says any system that can get these causal inputs and then have these behavioral outputs, right, and can interact with other states of mind, that's a thinking thing. We have a thinking thing. That's what intelligence is. And if that's what you think intelligence is, then again, you can instantiate that function in anything that's sufficiently sophisticated. It doesn't have to be made of carbon. It doesn't have to be a brain. It doesn't have to have neurons or have neural networks or what have you. It just has to be a sufficiently sophisticated material thing, network, that has a certain kind of functional organization that can take the same inputs and produce the same outputs, right? And what I'm describing here is a computer, right? Yeah. That's what a computer does. And it makes sense from what you're saying, because in a computer, we kind of outsource our intelligence to a machine, right? That's what's happening with the computer. We're outsourcing functions of our intelligence to a machine. And it's just a functional artifact that we've created that, you know, takes certain causal inputs and then spits out certain reactions and behavior. I just think that the question of functionalism is so central right now. And there's a lot of good arguments against it, by the way. It's not a very good theory. A lot of people are abandoning it today. Actually, you know, one of the most popular theories now is panpsychism. Have you looked into panpsychism at all?
Only via Thomas Nagel's Mind and Cosmos, which is about 10 years out of date. I did some research on Nagel's panpsychism, specifically his view of objective idealism via panpsychism. But it's been a while.
Yeah. So there has been such a failure. And I'm not speaking hyperbolic here. There has been such a failure to reduce the mental to the physical for the very reasons that we've already talked about here. Problem of consciousness, the problem of intentionality, the problem of rationality, abstract reasoning that you were talking about. It's been such an abject failure that a lot of materialists are just kind of stepping back and flipping the whole model upside down. So instead of starting at the ground level with inert, non-intentional, non-conscious bits of matter, and then kind of doing a construction project to kind of get to whatever mentality is. A lot of philosophers now, panpsychism has become very popular, are instead inverting that, and they're claiming that somehow, because we've totally failed to unpack consciousness from a bottom-up working of material constituents, they're saying what we need to do is throw that whole model out, and now we have to assume that the fundamental stuff of reality itself, this fundamental material stuff, is itself conscious already in some way.
Yeah, it's seeded with some sort of, it's seeded with sort of like proto-consciousness or something.
That's exactly
like that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's because there's been this construction problem. How mm-hmm. do you go from bits of matter, the fundamental constituents of reality that are themselves not conscious? How could mm-hmm. you ever build up to something that is conscious? It just seems like there's a massive construction problem there. So I'm just saying that to highlight the fact that it's not just you and I, you know, Aristotelian philosophers who also happen to be Christians, that, you know, we have a dog in this fight. But it's actually, it's a big issue right now in the philosophy of mind and this idea that we have to start with the right construction materials mm-hmm. to get to consciousness. That means we have to start with bits of matter that are themselves in some sense conscious. It just kind of gives you a forecast. It kind of gives you a picture of the power of some of the objections that you and I have raised here. So anyway, I don't know if there's anything else you want to say in that regard, but I was thinking maybe we could move on to maybe unpack this idea of how do we understand human intelligence in more of a classical Aristotelian Thomistic way.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was. My thoughts were going as well, because I was in looking at some of these, you know, even MIT guys who are questioning the what they call the hype of super intelligent AI, right? And that is that AI is it's an induction machine, right?
Right.
Induction is where you take, in this sense, you know, sometimes billions of instances of an example of a thing. And so what AI is really good at is this, is the rate at which it processes all of these instances and develops and spits out, like you said, inputs, outputs, it spits out these patterns. Some of these patterns look very intelligent. And so what one of these, I think Eric Larson says that, what AI doesn't do is it doesn't abduct, right? Now, I'm not a big fan of the sort of Freudian view of abduction, but what I think the notion of abduction gets at is it gets at the difference between inductive pattern recognition, which is what's going on in AI, and what humans do in their process of induction, because in Peter Kreef's Socratic Logic, he has a really good chart of showing this, that what happens in human knowing, so I'm getting to this, what is actually going on in human knowing. And what goes on in human knowing is, let me try and package a few things together. Because I want to also note what the notion of the power of the mind is. Hopefully I can do this without getting too scattered. But so this became clear to me in teaching epistemology, because in epistemology, there's this internalism-externalism debate. Mm-hmm. Is justification some sort of internal access to justifying reasons or evidence that something is true, a belief is true, or is it something that emerges from the context in which the belief is formed, right? So you have something like a planting on one side and all the Cartesians on the other side. And the problem with the internalism, and same thing with a lot of these contemporary analytic dichotomies, the problem is each camp has a portion of the truth.
Right.
And what I realized maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, after, you know, teaching epistemology for, you know, 10 years, is that Aquinas actually accounts for this, because somebody like an externalist, like a Plantinga, is going to say, well, you know, children certainly know things. Like I've watched my kids grow up, and at a fairly young age, they can distinguish an apple from a ball, from a giraffe, from a dog, right? But they don't have a rich internal monologue going, well, the reason I know this is an apple and not a dog,
right?
You know, they don't have that, but they do seem to have knowledge. And if you say they don't have knowledge until it just seems to make knowledge something, you know, it's hard to account for, children knowing. Anyway,
it becomes too restrictive. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So what Aquinas says is that the proper object of human cognition is sensible being, right? So as we're growing up, we start by knowing things. You know, everyone starts out as a realist. You know, it takes some pretty sophisticated philosophy to get you out of
that's right.
realism. You know. So everybody starts out as a realist. You know, you pet the dog, you scare the cat, whatever. But you start to know things, and this is how the knowing process starts. Then as you get older and your mind develops, you can start to reflect on knowing things. You can reflect on instances of knowing things. And this is where epistemology starts. It's not just knowing things. It's knowing how do we know things.
Right.
Right. And then we discover that we have these two distinct powers of knowing, sensation and intellection. And then what Aquinas says is that as you reflect on the knowing process, you come to understand that there has to be a power of knowing. And that's the mind.
That's right.
Which is an aspect of the immaterial soul, right? So so that's how Aquinas, something that is purely immaterial is never empirically directly available, right? I can see my laptop in front of me, but I can't see my mind. What I'm aware of is I'm aware of the laptop. I'm aware of my knowing process about the laptop. And then to account for that knowing process, I assume mind as the power by which the effect is produced, and the effect is my knowledge.
Right.
Because, otherwise, you have knowledge popping into existence ex nihilo, which doesn't have any sort of causal ground for it. So sort of blending the metaphysics and epistemology there. Okay, so that's sort of a brief brief context of human knowing and process, things, knowing itself, and the power of knowing being the mind. Then we switch over to the nature of induction. AI has this inductive process by which it becomes this pattern recognition machine, right? Or pattern producing machine. It produces patterns from a bunch of disparate instances, billions of instances, processed very quickly. Humans don't do that. Or humans do something that else. And that is, this goes back to Krafe's chart, is that from induction in terms of instances, there is an inductive, there's an abstraction process, right? We used triangles earlier. From multiple instances of geometric shapes, I abstract this universal notion of triangularity, which extends over every instance of triangles, right? And so this is something that AI doesn't do. It doesn't have an abstraction process whereby it forms a universal.
Doesn't form concepts.
Exactly. And one of my favorite instances of this, no pun intended, is Mark Lange. One thing I love about Thomism, just as a plug for the system that we use. When I first became a Christian, I immediately got interested in Christian apologetics, because I'm like, I'm committing myself to the fact that Jesus is the incarnate Son of God. He came and died for my sins. He wants me to be in heaven with him. He demands obedience and devotion and all these things and whatever. I'm like, I'm 19 years old. So I immediately started studying Christian apologetics, and my aim was to test this religious commitment, this personal devotion, with arguments for God's existence, arguments against God's existence, the historicity of the biblical text, the, you know what I mean? So then as a philosopher, as a Christian who studied philosophy and embraced Thomism, I've spent the last 15 or 20 years challenging my Thomistic principles in terms of philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, epistemology, you know, because I think if these principles are true, they should be able to withstand any sort of assault from any quarter, right? Metaphysics, whatever. Anyway. So I love reading people who are subject matter experts in this very narrow field, because they will say things, they will come to conclusions. And I will say, yeah, that's right. But the reason that's right is because Aquinas is right.
Right.
And I had the same experience reading Mark Lange. Mark Lange is a philosopher of science. Last time I checked, he was at University of UNC Chapel Hill. And he wrote a paper some years ago called Would Direct Realism, and a lot of people think Aquinas' epistemology fits nicely within a broadly understood direct realism. He says, would direct realism solve the classical problem of induction from David Hume? And he answers the question, yes, but he gives this history of science example where in the 1920s, they started astronomers started studying what he called stars with variable luminosity. So these are stars that sort of pulse. Now, I mean, their luminosity grows and diminishes as opposed to just having a static, you know, they go through cycles of luminosity, right? And Mark Lang looks at this historical example of, you know, they would see these stars sort of come onto their sky maps and then disappear for a while and then come, like, are these supernova? What kind of, you know, phenomena is this? Because they, up to that point, they didn't understand that some stars could have a variable, have life cycles of their luminosity.
Mm-hmm.
And he says they only needed about 30 or 40 examples of this phenomena to reason that there's a star that has a different kind of nature to it.
Right.
And his right. question is, and now that we're, you know, 100 years beyond that, we find out that that's exactly correct. But how did these early astronomers, from just, you know, less than four dozen examples, change their mind about the kinds of objects that populate our night sky, right? He said, it has to be that from a limited number of examples, we're able to understand that the best explanation is that there is some object objectively in the universe that consistently has these properties.
Right.
And he goes, but if there isn't something like abstraction or abduction, none of this reasoning would be sound, and yet it is. And so that's the kind of thing that at least Eric Larson is pointing out in his.
And by the way, really quick, Nancy Cartwright, who is a philosopher of science, points out in multiple books that this is the way science works. Sometimes we think that in order for us to come to some scientific conclusion, we just need thousands and thousands of instances to make a valid deductive inference. But Cartwright carefully shows that so many of our theories, so many of the things that we take to be scientific fact, have been concluded to from just a small handful of inductive inferences. So this is like what happens in science all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of his A.F. Chalmers, who I think is, he's either Australian or New Zealand. They're indistinguishable to me because I'm an ugly American. At the very end of his sort of introductory primer, what is this thing called science? He talks about powers and dispositions of things. And he goes, probably the best description of this is this Aristotelian view of agent-patient relationships or the ability to act and be acted upon, right? He says this model fits with physics and chemistry very nicely. And he says, I don't know why more philosophers of science don't embrace this kind of Aristotelianism. And what he doesn't understand is that there's this whole wide-ranging metaphysical commitment that start of form, matter, composition.
That's right.
And form is intelligible and immaterial.
That's right.
But from this narrow philosophy of science analysis, Chalmers is just like, yeah, I think Aristotle's basically right when it comes to this. And Lang is like, yeah, I think some sort of direct realism explains it. And I'm thinking, yeah, you guys are right. Because Aristotelian Thomism is right.
That's right. That's right.
So it's just a fun exercise, or at least it has been so far.
Yeah. So I think in a second I would like to just kind of zoom in on what is an intellect from that mm-hmm. perspective, from Aristotelianism and Thomism. But just to connect what you've been saying here to more of the contemporary conversation with mm-hmm. neuroscience and cognitive science and philosophy of mind. What you were relating there with the power of abstraction has been brought out on the contemporary scene, especially by a philosopher of mine named John Searle, very popular, until he was recently canceled, by the way. So I guess it's not good to refer to him anymore in our woke culture. But anyway, he points out the difference between syntax on the one hand and semantics on the other. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about syntax, the syntax of a language, right? And the semantics of a language. Syntax, we're talking about the formal structure or the formal.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all from Menards.
features of language, right? We're talking about the shape and position of letters, the rules of grammar.
Right.
And when we refer to semantics, we're not talking about anything formal or structural. We're actually talking about the meaning of the words and sentences in a language. And there is a distinction between the two. They are not the same thing. And what he points out is that what computers do, what any functional system does, the only thing that they can do is manipulate syntax, right? They can manipulate symbols. Computers are basically super sophisticated symbol manipulators.
That's right.
And he gives this argument, famous argument called the Chinese room argument, to show that no matter how sophisticated you are at manipulating symbols, right, which are physical things, no matter how good you get with syntax manipulation, it will never, ever deliver any semantic material, right? Because meaning is something completely different. And only human beings have the ability to have semantical knowledge. Only we can form concepts, and we can look at some squiggles on a sheet, and we can read it as a certain word that has a certain meaning behind it. And of course, you know, at the bottom of all of that is the ability to abstract, abstraction, and to be able to form concepts, and then to take those concepts and relate them to one another to make propositions or judgments, and then take those judgments and relate them to one another and reason, right? Follow rules of logic and make arguments. These are powers of an intellectual soul that computers can't touch. No matter how sophisticated a computer gets, it can only ever deal in syntax. It can ever be a symbol manipulation machine.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just want to point that out because it's a contemporary restatement of what you're saying about the power of the rational soul to be able to abstract and what's going on in induction, basically.
Yeah, and this is this again is George Sarkadakis, who's got a PhD in AI, and he says, so this is where I love sound philosophical reasoning, sort of paralleling what the scientists themselves are saying. He says this toward the end of his book. He says, this is an astounding insight that resonates perfectly with the findings of AI research. Although we can program a computer to process information and take autonomous actions, we cannot program it to cannot program one to understand meaning.
That's right.
Computers will always and forever be unable to comprehend the meaning of the words we use or which they use when communicating in natural language. So yeah, computers will never understand.
That's right. They'll only ever be able to manipulate symbols based on syntactical rules, by the way, which we have to encode for these computers to follow, but they'll never be able to form concepts. And if you don't form concepts, and this is key, if you don't form concepts, if you can't abstract, then you can't understand. You do not have understanding, because the ability to form concepts is what grounds the power of understanding.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's a good segue. Maybe we can spend the last 20 minutes or so here just reflecting on the nature of human intelligence from the perspective of the classics, you know, Plato, especially Aristotle, and then the Aristotelian tradition through some of the medievals like Thomas Aquinas. So what is a better view, JT, of human intelligence?
Yeah, so the intellect or the mind, like we said, we don't see it directly. What we see is we see the powers of the mind. And so Aquinas will say that there are three acts of the mind, right? So we're not looking at the mind directly. We're seeing the effect of the mind, and we're saying this is the power that produces that effect. One of the first act of the mind, he says, is called conceptualization or simple apprehension. It's simple in that it deals with concepts in a non-existential way, right? So in the world, we have things that have essences that have substantial forms, say. So somebody like Frederick Wilhelmson in his book, Man's Knowledge of Reality, The Introduction to Thomistic Epistemology, he'll say this. What we have is, and this is a great grandchild of Descartes, and that is this idea that when we can talk about knowledge, talking about knowledge is already a mistake. What we have to talk about is human knowing. Because what I'll say is, you know, frogs and humans and angels and God, there's no such thing as knowledge they all have in common.
Right.
Because a thing knows according to its mode of being. Animals know according to sensation. Humans know according to sensation and intellection. Angels only know through intellection, and God knows via his divine grasp of his own essence. Right. So when we talk about knowledge, way back when I was actually still on Facebook, I had an exchange with somebody about the nature of time. You know, I was giving this sort of this Aristotelian understanding of time being a
measure of change. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the response was, well, that's the human experience of time. And I said, everything about philosophy is describing the human experience.
That's
of
right. Life. That's you right. Know? Yeah.
So we're not trying to give a some explanation of time that's just so objective it's true for all things, regardless of their mode of being. No, we're trying to give same thing is true of knowledge. So what is human knowing? And human knowing is a power of the mind is the power of the soul by which we understand. It has three acts according to Aquinas. Simple apprehension, which is where the things in the world, it enables us to grasp those essences as mental representations. And so the other thing to note is that there's a notion of formal identity, because we often think in terms of mathematical identity, right? That is, your identity is numerically you're one and the same that you were, you know, just 15 minutes ago, right? So people think in terms of numerical identity, where we're talking about one and the same thing, but there's also such a thing as formal identity. Formal identity is when two distinct things have the same essence in common, and that's our humanity. So you're human and I'm human, and our humanity is identical, but not in a numerical way.
Right.
Then we'd be the same person, but in a formal way. And it's because we're essentially the same, even though whatever, anyway. So that's simple apprehension. And then there's judgment. So judgment tracks with not the essence of a thing, but its way of being. So when I say I have a gray cat, I'm predicating her name's Sheba. Sheba is gray, right? I'm taking this individual, this cat, and I'm predicating grayness of it. And the is there in this, the is, grammatically latches on to the mental judgment the cat is gray, and it predicates grayness of the cat. That is, there's something unified in reality that my analysis has broken up into subject and predicate grammatically, and I'm affirming that of a thing in the world, which is an existential judgment. This thing, the cat, is existing as gray colored, right? It's this one thing in the world, but that through judgment and analysis, I break up into subject and predicate, and I affirm it about the world. And that act of judgment tracks with the being of the thing in the world. And then finally, we have the third act of the mind, which is reasoning. And reasoning is just the way in which we use propositions to reason to a conclusion. Now, when I taught logic, Aristotelian logic, I asked my students this question on exam. Of these three acts of the mind, which is the most important? Conceptualization or simple apprehension, judgment or reasoning? And I would get a variety of answers, some of them wrong. But my opinion was this. Judgment is the most important act of the mind, because it's the act of the mind whereby some mental product, the judgment, latches onto something in the world, which is where truth resides. Truth resides
in this
accord between, because if I have a black cat and I say this cat is gray, the reason that judgment is false is because there's a discord between the thing in the world and the judgment of the mind, right? And the reason I say judgment is most important is because when we reason, you know, classical, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Premise one is what? It's a judgment.
That's
all
right.
Men are mortal. Premise two is a judgment.
So your arguments are only as good as your judgments.
That's exactly right. And our arguments can only be true if the judgment accords with the thing in the world.
That's right.
But what we're doing in reasoning is we're using this tool of logic as a means of measuring or securing the valid inferences between those propositions.
That's right.
So that's a brief.
I would just point out that every act of the mind, it presumes and assumes the first act of the mind, which is understanding. If you can't have understanding, and again, if you can't abstract from the particular and form the knowledge of a universal in your mind, if you can't have a concept, then you can't make judgments, because what you just said, this cat is gray. Well, cat and gray are both universals.
They're universals.
Those are both,
that's right.
Those are both concepts. Yep. And what we do when we reason is we take these judgments, which are made up of a subject and predicate, and they're suffused with concepts and universals, and then we relate those together. So we just said a moment ago that machines can only ever deal in syntax, mm-hmm. right? Never semantics. And we said that semantics was the core of understanding because it relates to this idea of abstraction and mm-hmm. conceptualization. Well, if that's the case, then there is no act of the human intellect that could ever be replicated in a computer, because every act of the intellect relies on first one, which is conceptual, which is this act of abstraction.
And furthermore, every act of the mind has this aspect of intentionality about it.
That's right.
Concepts, Socrates is a man. Man is about something.
Right.
Socrates is a man. The judgment is about something. Socrates is mortal is about something. So conceptualization and judgment and reason all have this property of intentionality about them, because human thinking is at its core intentional. It's both intentional and it's linguistic. Which is why the semantics aspect is so important.
And maybe we can close out on this. Mm-hmm. It's all of those things, and it's fundamentally immaterial.
That's right.
Yeah. So not only do we have a problem here with the idea of artificial intelligence from the perspective of the powers of the mm-hmm. intellect, which are just not reproducible in any kind of machine, but at the end of the day, intellect itself, intelligence, is immaterial, right? According to Aristotle and Aquinas. Now, mm-hmm. It starts from the fact that what we are as human beings are matter form composites, right? Mm-hmm. There's a material aspect to us, then there's a formal aspect to us, and the two are united. And obviously, the material aspect provides the material side, the physical side of our being. Mm-hmm. But then the formal side adds an immaterial aspect to our being, right? And that immaterial aspect for human beings is a rational soul, as you said. So in its very nature, rationality for the classical philosophers, especially Aristotle and then Aquinas, is fundamentally immaterial, right? And that means that understanding, that knowledge, is fundamentally immaterial. And if it is fundamentally immaterial, then it can never, by definition, be replicated in any physical system.
That's right. There's so much difficulty. I think non-Christian philosophers are at a real disadvantage, because they they're very much have a limited explanatory scope. They've hamstrung themselves. Because humans we're this hybrid. We're not animals. We're not angels. We're embodied souls. So we have these powers of knowledge and volition that transcend the sensible and material. But we also have things in common with animals, because we are animals. But we're rational animals, and so it's very easy for someone who either can't accept, won't accept, or just simply doesn't accept a broader Christian view. It's hard for them to embrace this oddness or this uniqueness of human experience, being neither completely animal nor completely spiritual. We're embodied spirits, right?
Yeah, so, in hylomorphism, this Aristotelian view, it also provides a way to integrate the two, right?
That's right.
Because we don't have to fall back on some Cartesian dualism that says have two distinct separate substances. And then it becomes a mystery and how do they interact, right?
Yeah.
And then we have, you know, neuroscience, which is telling us, hang on, although we can't prove that the mind is reducible to some physical process, firing of neurons, what have you, we can show that there is correlation, right? There is a deep correlation between what happens in the physical brain and the immaterial mind. Like the two are like fitting together like hand in glove. They can't be reduced, as we talked about already. There's not an identity between the two, but there is a deep correlation between the two. And it seems to me, as you were saying, we have resources as people coming from the classical tradition of philosophy to say, well, that makes perfect sense according to this Aristotelian model where you have matter, form, composite, and the two make one being, right? Don't have these, it's one substance, and this one substance has irreducible powers and properties that you know, the parts don't have on their own.
That's right.
So we bring these resources to the table that are just forgotten today, but that, I, like you said, especially, and one of the things that I'm passionate about is trying to reintroduce theology to her handmaiden, right? Classical philosophy. Like, I'm really passionate about that because this is just an example right here where we have the resources already, if you just look back in our history, to understand what's happening today with modern neuroscience and all the correlations that are being shown between the mind and the brain. It just fits perfectly with this Aristotelian idea of matter and form.
Yeah, my go-to example is that of a coin, because you have heads and tails, right? But you don't have two coins. You don't have a heads coin and a tails coin.
That's right.
You have a single coin that has both heads and tails. And so my usual phraseology is that the embodied soul or the mind body, they're distinct but inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
And then a Christian will say, well, what about this temporary disembodied state after death? And I go, yeah, that's an artificial state of affairs. It's not natural. And the way we know that, and I like having this conversation because it's like, fine, if you want to put it in the context of scripture, why is there a re-embodiment? Why is there a resurrection from
death?
That's
right. If
humans are in a superior state when they're a disembodied soul, then why would we be re-embodied? It's because our natural union with the body is what's intended for our personage.
Exactly. And it's so easy for Christians today, theologians, to fall into some kind of crude Platonism.
Right.
And again, good philosophy will save you from that. So anyway, JT, this has been awesome. I know we've been all over the place. We've covered a lot of stuff, and there is a ton more that we could talk about, even just focusing on the Aristotelian Thomistic perspective on this. But we are out of time, so I want to respect your time here today. But just again, thanks so much for joining me in this conversation. Tons of fun. Before we say goodbye here, where can people go if they're interested in what you're doing? Or I know you have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Where can people find out more about what you're providing?
Well, I've hesitated to fully embrace the social media aspect of life just because I'm increasingly becoming a curmudgeon. But I have recently started a YouTube channel. It's called A Considerate Life. So if they look that up, hopefully they'll find me.
I'll put a link to that in the description here.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest thing. I don't really have any other social media outlets currently, so that's probably the best way.
Okay, great. Well, again, JT, this has been tons of fun. Thanks so much for coming on, and we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, sounds good.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.